namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa buddhang dhammang sanghang sammi. So, here we are again, Saturday. I had a mosquito mainlining me. So when the mosquito bites me, that's a feeling, isn't it? And biologically, I'm repelled by that because my body wants to be safe and not be eaten by creatures. So biologically, I do something, but also psychologically, I react to it with aversion. That's natural enough. And then I can choose or not to move or move. So I chose to let it just suck my blood. And in that choosing, I could observe. I could observe feeling. I could observe aversion to this little critter that's eating me. And I could see that awareness can be with unfulfilled desire. I could be with something unpleasant, right? I could notice an unpleasant feeling and then actually be quite peaceful with it. So the peace of my mind isn't necessarily dependent on a pleasurable experience. If I would have reacted, just kind of reacted to it, then I would get, probably would have been a long meditation, first of all, because the little guy would keep coming back until he got his blood. And I could have got quite restless. It's a little lesson, isn't it? It's kind of, and I could use insect repellent and get better screens and all that. But much of life is just unrepentant mosquitoes that you can't get rid of, that do bite you, all kinds of situations, people who are human misunderstandings and sickness and all manner of kind of mosquitoes biting you in life. And obviously if our only way in life is to react with aversion and running away and distracting and so on, then we're always victims to the external. We never really find any kind of more profound peace in the heart because it's so much dependent on externals. So the contemplative life is one where we do the best we can with the externals. So, you know, we have screens, keep the doors closed, and so on and so forth, but we realize that this limit, the world and all the situation it comes to is very, very limited in terms of what we can control and can't control. And so obviously all of us are interested in, is there a deeper peace? Is there another possibility in the heart which isn't just always dependent and reactive to the trials and tribulations of our existence? And there is, and this is the beauty of the Buddhist teaching, that he offered a possibility for a very deep and peaceful compassion in human consciousness if we can just stay still for a while. You know, if we can just not constantly react to externalities and always try to find ourselves through external objects and situations. And that sense of just waiting and being patient is a huge part of meditation, a huge part. So the meditative practices that we do are really, they should not be, they're not meant to be divorced from ordinary life, right? They're not any different than ordinary life. They're just more refined maybe, or more attentive to the subtleties of inner movements that go on in our hearts. And I was describing before lunchtime to some of the friends here how in my early years of practice I would be in Thailand, and there was a lot of waiting around, waiting for a Dharma talk to start, and the teacher might be late, and then waiting for a meditation to finish because the teacher might just push us through. So maybe the meditation was usually an hour, and he just decided, Ajahn Chah decided, maybe, oh, we'll sit for 2 hours on a concrete floor without any cushions. So then there was this kind of hopefulness that he would ring the bell and I could get out of there. And then there'd be meal times, waiting for the meal to start. And then there'd be long Dhamma talks where I wouldn't understand what's going on and be waiting for the thing to end. So there's kind of a lot of waiting around. And in that waiting around, and Ajahn Chah was always encouraging us to know the mood of the mind. And I find it really very, very formative, actually, that in those times when I didn't have a chance to distract or find a something to absorb into, like a book or just run away, that I just had to learn how to meditate in very ordinary situations, not just this kind of meditation, but being mindful of what situations created in my mind. And so my life was much, much simpler then. You know, monastic life for then was so, so simple for me because I was a junior monk. I really had no administrative responsibilities, no teaching responsibilities. And there was work projects were really simple. So really it was really much that I had to think about worldly ways. So the situations were very simple. So the patterns of my mind were very repetitive. I'd just be annoyed that the meal would start, or I'd be fed up with the heat. That was a big one. Hot season in Thailand. I'm sure it was a million degrees. And before the rainy season, it got more and more humid. So much so that the robes started to rot because you couldn't dry them, and things, you know, simple things like that, which weren't grand things, but they were kind of repetitive annoyances, and then also repetitive experiences of joy, where Ajahn Chah would be really eloquent and charming, and I'd just pick up on his energy and feel very uplifted and inspired, and I'm going to do this rest of my life. And then 2 days later, I'm out of here. I'm going to jump, the walls drive me crazy. And because I think there was very little variety in sense experience, I began to see this movement of mind from inspiration to boredom, from hopefulness to hopelessness, from thinking I'm really practicing well now to think I was a basket case, and just back and forth and back and forth. And began to, and through Ajahn Chah's encouragement, and Ajahn Sumedho too, just see these are moods of the mind. And what was, I think, very formative for me, it wasn't so much just understanding the mood, but it's having that capacity to actually know there is a mood of the mind now creating a world through, it might be a mood of being very judgmental of other monks, or it might be a mood of feeling very inspired by my teacher. So before that, I would just be I would kind of notice that, but I would just follow these things, inspiration or disappointment, and not really see them as, they're just objects of mind, they're moods. They're just conditions, they're like inner weather. So beginning to notice that was it's a huge part of understanding yourself. So whatever the mood of the mind is, it will condition thoughts, won't it? It will condition the way I relate to you or to the monastery or to life in general. And if I'm not aware of that mood and I believe in the conditioning, then I create an ego, create a sense of self, and all the rest of it. But when you start to know the moods of the mind and you see that those moods come and go according to causes and conditions, you can discern which moods are skillful, which are unskillful. And you also sense that there's something deeper than the mood of the mind. And deeper than the mood of the mind is the silence of the mind. Because the silence of the mind, or the silence of awareness, or the spaciousness of awareness, is not really, it's not so much a mood as the knowing and awareness of the way things are. So I can, like this morning, like I Yeah, we're building this lovely building here for our community, and I'm beginning to see the errors I've made in my judgments. And, you know, I couldn't figure everything out, so naturally there's going to be some errors. And of course, when I notice these errors, they're not major. But when I notice it, my mind, of course, becomes critical. Wow, why didn't you think of that? And now that is a mood of the mind. It's conditioned by that situation that comes up. But because it's also been something that habitually goes into ego and self-thinking, then if I'm not careful, then I attach to that mood. You know, I was just watching, like last night and this morning, how my, you know, I noticed an error in the building. Again, it's no big deal, but I wish I would have seen that a year and a half ago. And it wasn't the architects, it's no big deal. But my mind wanted to make it a big deal. Now, and I noticed that what was happening is watching this mood of the mind, as the attention started to pick up that mood, it started to color the whole project. And the whole project began to have a sort of negative vibe to it. Again, it was no big deal. I could see it. I could let it go. But it was very interesting to see how one little detail conditions a critical response in the mind. That critical response then begins to dominate and then begins to interpret everything as a kind of a color to the situation. Really interesting to watch. Now, critical faculty, you know, it's good. If I see errors, I try to correct them and do better all I can. But when you think about it, an impulse, which is, if you attach to an impulse, it becomes a habit. If you attach to a habit, it becomes a personality. If you attach to a personality, it becomes a destiny. And you see how a person who is unaware of, say, something simple like that, the critical faculty as a mood, not just as a kind of a functional skill, because there is functional skill in being critical, but just a kind of judging and a kind of negativity around that, the person doesn't see that, and then they allow themselves to believe that that's around like another person maybe, you see another person, and there's something in their behavior which is justifiably, you can criticize it. Okay? That might only be 10% of their, 5%, 1% of their life or their personality, but the mind picks up on that, and because we're not aware maybe of, this is just a mood, this is just a perception, begin to just see that in the person. And just the mind keeps going to that. And each time you see the person, of course, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the mind is now noticing that. It notices that, and then it looks for that. And the tragedy of that is that then the mind begins to do that with everything else until the world is seen in a very critical and negative way and goes back to oneself. That's an extreme. But it's what happens when we're unawake, when we are we believe in this kind of creations that come up into our mind. And this is one of the ways we think about karma. When we use this word karma, quite often in the West it's used as a sort of almost fatalistic. My karma is that I'm myopic. So maybe I looked at someone in the wrong way in a past lifetime and now I've got bad eyes or something like that. Or something happens to me and I think, oh, it's my karma. So it's a kind of almost fatalism there, or crime and punishment kind of idea. But actually, you can't really reflect on that. I don't know what happened in a past lifetime or something. But what I can reflect on is the accumulation of habits. That I can see. That I can see happening in the present moment. So that's something I can work with. And one of the things that my teachers have taught me, that the stuff of Buddhism that really works is the things you can reflect upon. When I can really reflect upon something, a teaching, I can take it in a reflective way, then I can work with that and use it for my own edification. But when it's just a kind of belief system that I believe or disbelieve, then I just take on ideas and cultural positions, and it's just a whole set of beliefs. So change maybe from a, a Christian mindset to a Buddhist mindset, but it really doesn't edify me, it doesn't liberate me. So just kind of awakening to this movement of habit, say. So whatever, you know, when I came into Buddhism, I had cultivated 23 years of habits at least, and if there are previous lives, who knows where. And then those were the things I had to understand and to endure a lot too. Habits where I didn't know how to meditate, or I didn't know how to be still, I was very restless, or whatever. And then there's just the biological part of me too, just the human drives of a young man, just the way that worked. And that's just part of our karma and our physiological equipment. And in that, in Buddhism, we're not trying to find perfection in that. We're not trying to find perfection. What we're trying to actually, I would say, what we're trying to do is find why we can't abide as awareness within that whole structure of biology and karmic momentum, if you will. Why can't I just be with the way things are and watch them arise and see? So the recommendation in Buddhist practice is to relate to this, the movement of karma, or just the movement of the feelings of a human being incarnate in the body, just to relate to those through change. So the mood comes up in the morning, this morning, mood comes up, and because I was trying to, yesterday I was trying to address some of the complexities which this decision made, right? So yesterday I was dealing with that. So today the first thing that comes up in the morning is, of course, some of those ideas around this error in judgment. Now, if I'm awake, right from the moment I wake up, right from the moment I can see, well, this is a mood of the mind, and it's conditioning a future or a sense of self. And if I'm really aware of that, I can see, well, is this really worthwhile? Is it necessary? Is it going to lead to my well-being and others' well-being? Or is it just an impulse leading to a habit developed as a personality and creating a destiny? Is it just karma? Is it just the momentum of the way my mind has been conditioned? I could see that was it. It was just having developed a critical faculty which was well honed to self-criticism and criticism of others through my culture, through whatever, my preferences. That's the karma of the mind. It's just a habit of the mind. And just seeing that and seeing how strong that was, actually, although rationally, I could say, well, this is ridiculous. This is nothing. So just dismissing things sometimes doesn't work, because in this case, it would be another kind of critical sensitivity or critical judgment. But just noticing how the habit arises and the mind wants to run with the thoughts through that habit. So it might be criticism, it might be fantasizing, it might be regretting, it might be anxiety, it might be like fearful of the past or whatever. And these moods of the mind, they quickly go into thought, don't they? I mean, just so quick it goes into whatever the scenario is. And the contemplative life, the meditative life, is trying to have enough distance and space around, oh, this is just a mood. And to relate to it as something that has arisen, it'll stay for a while and it will cease. To do that, one has to learn how to not just to run with the thinking mind, not to run with another thinking, like I shouldn't be critical, it's not a problem, because that's usually just trying to suppress it. Although you can use good thoughts, I could say. You know, I could say, it's not a problem, don't make it a problem. But not to get rid of it, just to find balance. So as the mood comes up and one's aware of it, and one makes choices to relate to it through the perception of change. This is changing. How does it change? If you can stay with that, that always gives you a kind of distance. It gives you a perspective. It gives you a kind of spaciousness around the particular karmic formation you have. If I think I shouldn't think like that, then there's no space around that. If I'm just lost in it, there's no space around it, and that's what we call rebirth. So rebirth, in a psychological sense, rather than in a many lifetimes since. Rebirth is this constant recreation of a sense of self driven by impulse and habit and personality that is constantly coming up into our minds. And so we're not trying to create a different kind of personality, we're just trying to see that that movement of ego or self or thinking, when it's just driven by these habits, is suffering, and that you can be free from that by finding the spaciousness of awareness. So the language you use, this arises and ceases in awareness, rather than I am someone who shouldn't feel like that. So I noted that this morning, the mind, it kind of tried to do that for about a half an hour. It was almost like we have this image of Mara, don't we? Mara the tempter. Kind of like one of the sirens in Greek mythology, or just this voice saying, "You're an idiot! You bloody fool!" It's just, I said, "I'm not believing you, I'm sorry." And it's so tempting, and this is the sort of weird thing about human psychology, is that, you know, something which is actually not very wise, not very loving, and terribly unjoyful can seduce us. And we can go off into realms of suffering that everyone will look at you and say, "You what? Why would you do that? It's not logical." And that's the problem with karma, it's often not logical. Logically we can see it. But the pull and the force of habit is quite often actually very strong. So these like, again, going back to those early days in Thailand, I realized, you know, I was just thinking about that today, how fortunate I was that through these simple repeated patterns of boredom or dullness or restlessness, I could just again and again, I'd see, oh, that's a mood, that's a mood, that's a mood, until the practice of knowing the mood of the mind became more strong than the tendency to attach to moods. So it was more than just the mood, it's that capacity. And this, we in our text, we call the third foundation of mindfulness, the cittanupassana, the ability to know the mood of the mind. And quite often people, when you say that, they try to maybe analyze or find a name for the mood. You don't really need a name. You just know that, I think that the indicator is it's creating thinking. It's creating certain kinds of self-thinking. Functional criticism, let's say I look at the garden, I see the you know, flowers look withered, I think, oh, better give them some water. That's functional criticism. That's good, isn't it? You know, I see cause and effect, and I make a decision to try to make things better in some way. So that's functional. You need that. But attachment to habits is always creating a sense of a self, a person, a me, and a problem. So we all have that, don't we? So I've got this idea, why didn't I do that? I should have done this and that. And that's what we're trying to awaken to, that is a thought, that is not who you are, it's just a bunch of ideas driven by a particular kind of mood. And so then the more you recognize that your karma, as we say, the more you recognize the habits and moods that you tend to kind of get absorbed into, the more you just know, oh, I know that one, I saw that. Well, I've seen this for the last 20 years or something like that. And you begin to just recognize, oh, that's just karma. It's not right or wrong, you're not bad. It's just not worth following. It's not worth investing. So even not even worth trying to get rid of. It's not a problem. It just is. It just is the force of habit. And then there's a kind of sense of relief there. Because you no longer have to be the perfect person that has no karma. You no longer have to be the person that has some kind of inner configurations which are always perfect and inspired and joyous and happy and loving. Da, 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 da. No, they're just that way. And that relief, or that sense of relief, brings you to the refuge of awareness. So I always recommend if you just find those spaces of awareness in your life by listening, by just drinking a glass of water mindfully, by walking down the stairs of your house mindfully, just doing that, to have a sense of to try to create a sense of what would it be, that's what we're doing. Like in your meditation, when your mind, maybe you're sleepy or you're planning what you have to do at work next week or something, and then you notice planning or worrying. That moment when you notice that, I always recommend make that a happy moment. Make, oh God, I'm back. Make it really like optimistic or positive. This is the path. Nothing else to do, just that. Because if you do that, the mind relaxes into the present moment. But if you're unaware that when you find yourself thinking, then you try to get rid of thinking, the meditation won't work. It'll just be a kind of inner warfare. So we make intentions, we make determinations, but the determination is not to become anything special, but to know what is. So begin the meditation and say, so how is it now? And if you try to answer that, well, I feel good, then that's not the point of it. How is it now before you think, pre-verbally, pre-conceptually, before you make an analysis, how is it now? And notice how a question brings you to silence. What is it like now? And a question can always bring you to silence. If you need an answer all the time, then you go more into thinking. So one of the ways we can abandon the whole personality view that we get caught up into, so what's this moment like now? Or what's this moment feel like? Or what is the mood like? Quite often the mood's nothing strong. It's just a habit. You can't localize it. You don't notice it as anything much, but you're back in the present moment. So the rebirth would be this sort of continual restructuring of a sense of self through these moods. So in the morning, this morning, that the habit of self-criticism is something that is the karma, right, of my conditioning. Then the mindfulness was just to know that's a mood of the mind, and the habit was to just recreate a sense of self. Now, if I'm not aware of the habit, what happens is that I just retrench that, don't I? I just get deeper into it, and the more I think in those ways, the more I'll think when there's in the future. So an impulse becomes a habit, becomes a personality. But each time I notice that's just a mood, and I don't grasp it, I don't make a problem out of it, I see it as a mood. Each time I do that, the tendency, the habit begins to fade away. Right? So it begins to fade away because I don't feel it anymore. And that's what we mean by letting go, or non-grasping, or non-attachment, just that. And you can see it takes a lot of patience. Because you just gotta stay with the project, because these habits are so very powerful. Now the attitudes that we try to bring to that are very, very much heart attitudes, I think, rather than just intellectual attitudes. Intellectual attitudes are good, like, you know, we sort of see cause and effect, but very often we're unable to have the patience or the compassion or kindness to bear with these things. And so quite often there's a tendency of just trying to get rid of things, get them out of there. Because who wants this nonsense in the mind? I don't want this. I'd rather have bliss and an angel singing in my ear in the morning. I don't want this. I didn't wake up for this. So there's a very easy tendency just to be averse to these things, to try to get rid of it. Or just to be lost in it. Those are the two, you know, that we quite often go. You just find yourself thinking for an hour, and then you realize, wow, I've been worrying for an hour, I've been judging someone for an hour. So the awakened mind is very much a receptive mind. It's very much like an open mind which welcomes this moment, and then in that welcoming, you know what this moment is like, because you're no longer just trying to get the good things and get rid of the bad things. So the welcoming, I see welcoming and this kind of awake quality is very synonymous with the mind which is awake to the way things are. And in that welcoming, then you can make choices. So when I welcome this moment, I can make a choice not to think unskillfully. I can make a choice not to speak, there's still discernment going on. But it seems to me the initial attitude has to be one of allowing this moment to be what it is. allowing this moment to surface, allowing it to be what it is. And then from that, you have what we mean, I think, the way I would see it, is what we call sati sampajanya. There's two words you find used a lot in Buddhism: mindfulness and clear comprehension. Where you discern, or mindfulness and discernment. Like when I walk on the road, and I'm walking, and I've got clogs, and we've got clogs. You don't call them clogs; you call them turtles, not turtles, or what are they, Crocs. Crocs. So I got a pair of Crocs. Some turtles. When I walk to my kuti, because it's a gravel road, I inevitably pick up rocks. And because of the way the Crocs are made, you can't, they don't fall out, they fall in all the time, right? So so walking along, I don't have to think about stones in my shoe. I know there are stones in my shoe, and I know what to do. I don't have to think about it. So discernment is always there, isn't it? You know what's going. You know when the road is level or not level. You know when the deer fly are trying to get your head, and you put your hat on, etc., etc. So discernment is a kind of natural wisdom that is functioning if we allow it to function. If we allow it to just, if we allow ourselves enough silence to be with the way things are. I think the innate wisdom of human consciousness, and then the accumulated wisdom of our maturity, because we've learned a lot, you know, we've been through a lot, and we've made our mistakes and had our successes and failures. So there's a whole accumulated understanding of life, both in psychological terms, social terms, and kind of dharmic terms, and that will serve us if we just allow ourselves just to be quiet. And what's it like now? And that to me is like a sense of trust and openness and welcoming. So when you allow the mind to just function from mindfulness and discernment, then good choices can be made. It's not like you have to think about all of them. Sometimes you have to if they're functional. And this sort of quiet, well, Ajahn Sumedho calls it, he calls it intuitive awareness or discernment and awareness. This is the kind of language we use in Buddhism. That way of being quite often is not cultivated, because what we cultivate quite often is just a critical mind. We're always judging and analyzing, and we need to do that. But to give that discerning function or wisdom function a chance, just to handle the material, as it were. You know, just leave it alone. What's it really like? And then you'll be amazed at how much insight comes from that. But because we have these habits, and we're reactive habits, and maybe, you know, we judge ourselves and we try to get rid of this and try to get rid of that, that discernment doesn't have a chance to function. So trust, you know, to actually trust and awareness, and let it work it out. Let that work it out, rather than my judging mind. And that's one of the things we're trying to do in meditation, is develop a way of being with this moment in a trusting way, rather than an aggressive way, or a way where we're trying to attain to something or get rid of something. And this is very different. When we make effort, usually, like now, I'm making an effort to get rid of the pain in my knee, right? So that's an effort to get a result. So we need to do that. If the fan's not working, I want cooler air, I switch the fan on. So that's one way we make effort. We make effort to get something or to get rid of something, right? And that's the functional way of making effort. But the subtlety of Buddhist contemplative and meditative life, we're making the effort to awaken, right? And then see that awake mind really is where peace and deep freedom lies. So we're not, this is why it's so difficult perhaps to meditate, because we use, if I'm making effort at this point, then I hope that 5 minutes later I'll get a good result. But in Buddhist meditation, the result is the awakened mind. So each time I notice that, oh, this is the way it is, that is the result. You've got it. You don't have to get anything else. And there you need patience and trust and faith. But the desire mind, so like if you've read things about attainments, or you've had experiences, or you think you have to get rid of something, the desire mind comes in and tries to get some other event in the future. And of course, it just feels frustrated all the time. So the thing about habits, and going back to that, impulse, habit, personality, destiny, the trouble with habit is that it becomes a kind of unskillful psychological posture almost. Like, you know, if you've got a bad posture that you've developed for a long time, and someone who does Feldenkrais or does yoga and corrects your posture, you feel off. You know, I'm used to kind of leaning over on starboard, and that's what my body, maybe like, maybe I wrecked my knee at one time, and then I had an operation, and slowly I kind of walk and sit tilted to the right, say. And then someone comes along 10 years later and says to me, well, you're really tilted to the right. I say, no, I'm not, because I've gotten used to tilted to the right. And it's the same with these habits that we have. They become these kind of insidious realities that we think are ultimate realities, and it's actually hard to rectify them because they're habits. You know, that's the difficulty with a habit. That's the difficulty with a posture which is off. So the comfortable thing to do is to follow the habit. So the comfortable thing quite often is like to be self-critical. That's because that's what the mind has done so often, just to go towards that, self-criticism. And the unfamiliar is to say, no, it's okay. This is the way it feels now. That's unfamiliar. It's unfamiliar. Peace is oftentimes unfamiliar. What's more familiar is these other things. And the thing about meditation is that it can get you, it can help you cultivate this more accepting and awake attitude in the confinements of something like a posture and a meditation session where you're not challenged by complexity. And there's a particular power about sitting for an hour or half an hour. There's a particular kind of power because your intentions are very much focused on just doing one thing, and that's being awake. They're not scattered all over the place doing all kinds of things. So they're very focused on just doing this one thing, being awake, staying present. It might not seem like it works. You know, I wasn't very present. But that intention, that continual intention, has tremendous power. And I think all of us who meditate regularly see that you make the intentions to be present for half an hour in the morning, half an hour in the evening, or an hour, or whatever, then you're going to be much more present during the day because you've made those intentions. So now the rather than impulse, habit, personality dominating, what begins to dominate is the intention to awaken. Now that dominant kind of attitude then begins to see impulse as an object, begins to see habit as an object, begins to see personality as an object and doesn't attach to it. So there's a kind of accumulation of what we call parami, or virtuous qualities, or the awake mind, which now has much more power than the habits, much more power, because the habits are seen for just what they are. And so that's the path of liberation. So the path of liberation is a present moment awakening and a more continuous present moment awakening. So the path always leads to the present moment. It always comes back to this point. So it's a strange way to talk about a path, but it's not like the pathway takes you to something in the future. It's rather a capacity to know the present moment in a more continuous way. When I began meditation, my first offering of awareness practices was from a Danish graduate student at U of T. Interesting guy. And this was in 1968. I don't have any gray hair today. So anyway, he gave me a book on the psychology of awareness. And all I remember about that was it was riveting, but I would only surface in awareness every 4 months. I just get lost in college life or whatever I was lost into, and every now and then I'd notice, you know, stick my head above the water, notice what was going on, and submerge again. So that's what meditation feels like sometimes, doesn't it? You know, like every 10 minutes you emerge from your thoughts. But just one moment of awakening is tremendously valuable. If you make it valuable, so this is it, I'm back, right? So if you reaffirm that as something which is skillful, which is wholesome, which is the path, that is the path, that is the goal, if you keep reaffirming it, then you'll remember it more. But if you reaffirm an attitude, oh gosh, I've been thinking too much, I have to try harder not to think, you just make yourself restless. So your intention is not to get rid of thinking, but it's to know thought as an object, something that comes and goes, not a problem. To know habit as an object that comes and goes, to know bodily feeling. And that's why we use body a lot. The body is a very present kind of thing going on, or sound, very simple things, and learn how to train our attention with them. So you train your attention with sound, with bodily feeling, with breath. So it's not about the breath or the sound, it's the awareness. But these are normal, present moment kind of things that are very, very helpful to train with. So we don't use exciting things, or we don't use things which require a kind of energy of desire. That's why it's so boring, right? It's not like watching some really clever program on YouTube or something like that. That's easy to pay attention to that. If you get a really interesting speaker or science program or music or whatever, and you like it, right? That doesn't take much skill to rivet your attention onto it. But now we're not observing life just through liking it. You know, when you sit in meditation, like, you're not supposed to, I mean, if you like it all the time, good on you, your meditation is quite good. But the idea that 45 minutes of meditation is going to be pleasant, you know, it just doesn't happen for most of us. So it's unpleasant, it's pleasant, it feels like you're getting somewhere, you're not getting anywhere, but all the time you're aware. So the feeling comes up, I'm not getting anywhere, that's just a feeling. The feeling comes up, I made it, that's just a feeling. The feeling, oh man, this is what I should do for the rest of my life, that's just a feeling. Never going to do it again, that's just a feeling. So all the time you're developing awareness, 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 rather than just believing in the moods of the mind. And that the moods of the mind are rich, obviously, they're very unreliable. But the awareness is where you find reliability and refuge. So that's the opening to the peace of the mind.